From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Those who stormed this Capitol, and those who instigated and incited, and those who called on them to do so, held a dagger at the throat of America, at American democracy.
On the first anniversary of the January 6th Capitol insurrection, President Biden denounced his predecessor, Donald Trump, for spreading a web of lies about the 2020 election and inciting his supporters to attack the Capitol. We hear part of Biden's speech and speak to historian Ruth Ben-Bigiat, a leading scholar on fascism, then to Sudan. Three protesters were killed in Sudan Thursday, bringing to 60 the total number killed since October's military coup. We'll go to Khartoum for the latest. And we speak to New York emergency room Dr. Craig Spencer on the skyrocketing number of COVID cases. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden marked the first anniversary of the January 6th Capitol insurrection by denouncing Donald Trump for inciting his supporters to attack the Capitol in an effort to overturn the 2020 election. In a speech from Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol, Biden accused Trump of spreading a web of lies and claimed the former president, whom he did not name, is placing a dagger at the throat of American democracy.
For the first time in our history, a president had not just lost an election, he tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power as a violent mob breached the Capitol. But they failed. They failed. And on this day of remembrance, we must make sure that such attack never, never happens again.
Inside the House chamber, Speaker Nancy Pelosi led a moment of silence to open a congressional ceremony marking the anniversary of the Capitol assault. Just two Republicans joined the proceeding, Congressmember Liz Cheney of Wyoming and her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney. After headlines, we'll hear extended remarks from Biden's address and speak with an expert on the psychology of authoritarianism. U.S. coronavirus infections have set another record high, with the number of confirmed cases now averaging more than 610,000 a day. Hospitalizations are rising sharply, while an average of more than 1,400 U.S. residents are dying of COVID-19 each day. The Washington Post reports the White House is finalizing plans with the U.S. Postal Service to deliver 500 million free coronavirus test kits to households that request them. This comes as USPS is asking for a temporary waiver on vaccine requirements for its own 650,000 workers, saying the rule threatens to delay mail deliveries. The White House said Thursday it has no plans to grant the waiver. Today, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in two challenges to President Biden's vaccine mandates affecting nearly 100 million workers. The World Health Organization says governments logged a record 9.5 million coronavirus infections around the globe last week, a 71% jump from the prior week. On Thursday, World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus confirmed reports that the fast-spreading Omicron variant is less likely to produce severe disease, but warned it should not be categorized as a mild virus.
Just like previous variants, Omicron is hospitalizing people and it's killing people. In fact, the tsunami of cases is so huge and quick that it is overwhelming health systems around the world.
Mexico's official COVID-19 death toll is set to pass 300,000. That's the fifth highest death toll of any nation, though disease experts believe the true toll is much higher due to lapses in testing and reporting. India reported over 117,000 positive coronavirus tests Friday, the most since early June, as Omicron spreads rapidly in urban areas. The British government has deployed 200 military personnel to London hospitals amid staffing shortages due to COVID-19. In France, lawmakers have approved a bill requiring everyone 16 and up to show a vaccine pass to access public places. In Brazil, Far-right President Jair Bolsonaro Thursday blasted his government's approval of Pfizer COVID shots for 5 to 11-year-olds and insisted he would not allow his 11-year-old daughter to be vaccinated.
I ask you, are you aware of a child aged 5 to 11 who has died of COVID? I'm not.
A study by the public health organization Vital Strategies found nearly 3,000 children in Brazil under the age of 10 have died of COVID-19 by the summer of 2021. Meanwhile, Chile Thursday announced it'll begin rolling out fourth COVID-19 vaccine shots, becoming the first country in Latin America to offer a second booster dose. Kazakhstan's authoritarian president, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, has ordered troops suppressing a mass uprising to shoot without warning, rejecting calls to hold talks with protesters whom he called criminals and murderers. According to the Kazakh Interior Ministry, 44 people, including 18 security officers, have been killed in recent violence. President Tokayev also thanked Russian President Vladimir Putin for sending in troops. The deadly crackdown came in response to what started demonstrations against rising fuel prices and widened to broader anti-government protests. On Thursday, a UN spokesperson called on security forces to respect protesters' rights.
The important thing is that security forces, whether they are Kazakh or whether they are non-Kazakh troops, need to uphold the same human rights standards, which is to show restraint and protect people's rights to demonstrate peacefully.
The United Nations says three refugees were killed, including two children, when airstrike hit a refugee camp Wednesday in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region. The UN did not say who was responsible for the assault, but Ethiopia's military has the only air force in the area. Ethiopia's government has repeatedly denied targeting civilians throughout its 14-month-old war in Tigray. Aid workers and witnesses say at least 146 people have been killed and over 200 injured in airstrikes in Tigray since mid-October. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot dead a Palestinian man, 21-year-old Bakir Mohammed Hashash, during a raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus Thursday. Hours later, an Israeli settler drove his car into a Palestinian man, 25-year-old Mustafa Falana, near a checkpoint, killing him. Meanwhile, far-right Israeli protesters attacked a Palestinian photojournalist in front of a hospital near Tel Aviv. The attackers were protesting the release of Hisham Abu Hawash, who recently ended his 141-day hunger strike after being granted release from administrative detention where he was being held without trial or charge. In Haiti, suspected gang members killed two journalists on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince Thursday. The reporters were on location to interview the leader of a rival gang. A third journalist managed to escape the brutal attack. Police identified the victims as local reporter Wilgens Lucent and Amadi John Wesley, who worked with Canadian radio station Écoute FM. The killings come amidst a worsening security situation in Haiti, 6 months after the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Earlier this week, the U.S. arrested and charged Colombian national Mario Palacios in connection with Moïse's killing. The director of the U.S. Bureau of Prisons is resigning amidst growing problems in the agency's handling of the pandemic. Michael Carvalho was appointed to the post in February 2020 by Trump's Attorney General Bill Barr. About a third of federal prisoners have tested positive for coronavirus, and at least 275 have died of COVID-19. Carvalho's tenure was also marked by reports of serious abuse and misconduct involving correctional officers. An Associated Press investigation found more than 100 federal prison workers have been arrested, convicted, or sentenced for crimes since the start of 2019, including a warden indicted for sexual abuse and another charged with murder. In Buffalo, New York, newly unionized Starbucks workers walked off the job Wednesday, citing safety concerns amid staff and other shortages during the ongoing COVID surge. Starbucks Workers United said, quote, the company has again shown they continue to put profits above people. In other labor news, a group of nurses, unions, and the AFL-CIO are demanding the federal government enact permanent rules to ensure workplace safety some 2 years into the COVID pandemic. The group says all frontline health workers should be guaranteed personal protective equipment, exposure notification, ventilation systems, and other life-saving measures. National Nurses United said, quote, going to work should not mean putting your life and the lives of your loved ones in danger. In Pennsylvania, two activists were arrested as they shut down construction on the Mariner East pipeline in Chester County. The fracked gas pipeline is being built by Sunoco, which is owned by Energy Transfer Partners and threatens Marsh Creek Lake, a drinking water source for 1.75 million people. The toxic gases are exported to manufacture plastics overseas. The pipelines already caused major spills in Marsh Creek, leading to dozens of criminal charges against Energy Transfer Partners. In Minnesota, three former Minneapolis police officers charged with federal civil rights violations in George Floyd's murder will go on trial January 20th. Officers Thomas Lane, J. Alexander King, and Totau stood by and watched as Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd, pressing his knee into Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes. The three faced charges of aiding and abetting murder and manslaughter in a separate trial set to begin in a Hennepin County court in March. And Minneapolis civil rights journalist and activist Mel Reeves died Thursday due to complications of COVID-19. He was 64 years old. Reeves was community editor at the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the oldest Black-owned newspaper in the state. Last April, Democracy Now! Spoke with Mel Reeves as the murder trial of George Floyd's killer, Derek Chauvin, got underway.
I'm not just a writer and journalist. I'm an activist. So I've been on the ground of actually organizing against police violence. In fact, I pushed back against folks saying that the fight was just a fight for racial justice. It was a fight for justice, and it was a fight for that demanding very clearly prosecution of the police. We've been trying to hold the police accountable here. And part of that is fueled by the fact that the police in Minneapolis and St. Paul have not changed their behavior.
Mel Reeves was unvaccinated against coronavirus and died after a weeks-long struggle with COVID-19. In December, he spoke out from his hospital bed urging people to get vaccinated. He survived by his son and five grandchildren. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden marked the first anniversary of the January 6th Capitol insurrection by denouncing Donald Trump for inciting his supporters to attack the Capitol in an effort to overturn the 2020 election. In a speech from Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol, Biden accused Trump of spreading a web of lies and claimed the former president, who he did not name, is placing a dagger at the throat of American democracy. This is part of Biden's address.
Here is the God's truth about January 6, 2021. Close your eyes. Go back to that day. What do you see? Rioters rampaging, waving for the first time inside this Capitol, Confederate flag that symbolized the cause to destroy America, to rip us apart. Even during the Civil War, that never, ever happened. But it happened here in 2021. What else do you see? A mob breaking windows, kicking in doors, breaching the Capitol. American flags on poles being used as weapons, as spears. Fire extinguishers being thrown at the heads of police officers. A crowd that professes their love for law enforcement assaulted those police officers, dragged them, sprayed them, stomped on them. Over 140 police officers were injured. We all heard the police officers who were there that day testify to what happened. One officer called it, quote, a medieval battle, and that he was more afraid that day than he was fighting the war in Iraq. They've repeatedly asked since that day, how dare anyone, diminish, belittle, or deny the hell they were put through. We saw with our own eyes rioters menace these halls, threatening the life of the Speaker of the House, literally erecting gallows to hang the Vice President of the United States of America. But what did we not see? We didn't see a former president who had just rallied the mob to attack, sitting in the private dining room off the Oval Office in the White House, watching it all on television and doing nothing for hours. As police were assaulted, lives at risk, the nation's capital under siege. This wasn't a group of tourists. This was an armed insurrection. They weren't looking to uphold the will of the people. They were looking to deny the will of the people. They were looking to uphold. They weren't looking to uphold a free and fair election. They were looking to overturn one. They weren't looking to save the cause of America. They were looking to subvert the Constitution. This isn't about being bogged down in the past. It's about making sure the past isn't buried. That's the only way forward. That's what great nations do. They don't bury the truth. They face up to it. Sounds like hyperbole, but that's the truth. They face up to it. We are a great nation. My fellow Americans, in life there's truth, and tragically there are lies. Lies conceived and spread for profit and power. We must be absolutely clear about what is true and what is a lie. And here's the truth. The former president of the United States of America has created and spread a web of lies about the 2020 election. He's done so because he values power over principle, because he sees his own interest as more important than his country's interest, than America's interest, and because his bruised ego matters more to him than our democracy or our Constitution. He can't accept he lost, even though that's what 93 United States senators, his own attorney general, his own vice president, governors and state officials in every battleground state have all said. He lost. That's what 81 million of you did as you voted for a new way forward. He has done what no president in American history, the history of this country, has ever, ever done. He refused to accept the results of an election and the will of the American people. While some courageous men and women in the Republican Party are standing against it, trying to uphold the principle of that party, too many others are transforming that party into something else. They seem no longer to want to be the party of Lincoln, Eisenhower, Reagan, the Bushes. But whatever my other disagreements are with Republicans who support the rule of law and not the rule of a single man, I will always seek to work together with them to find shared solutions where possible. Because if we have a shared belief in democracy, then anything is possible. Anything. And so at this moment, we must decide, what kind of nation are we going to be? Are we going to be a nation that accepts political violence as a norm? Are we going to be a nation where we allow partisan election officials to overturn the legally expressed will of the people? Are we going to be a nation that lives not by the light of the truth, but in the shadow of lies? We cannot allow ourselves to be that kind of nation. Those who stormed this Capitol, and those who instigated and incited, and those who called on them to do so, held a dagger at the throat of America, at American democracy. They didn't come here out of patriotism or principle. They came here in rage, not in service of America, but rather in service of one man. Those who incited the mob, the real plotters who were desperate to deny the certification of this election, defy the will of the voters.
President Biden speaking Thursday at the Capitol to mark the first anniversary of the deadly January 6th insurrection. Delaware Congressmember Lisa Blunt Rochester spoke later as part of a day of commemoration on Capitol Hill.
On the day that I was sworn into Congress, as many of my colleagues know, I was the first African American and the first woman from the state of Delaware elected to Congress, and I carried this scarf with me. It marked an X that my great-great-great-grandfather used to sign this returns of qualified voter registration of 1867 in Georgia. I also carried it on the day of the insurrection because it is my proof of what we have overcome. And it is my inspiration for what is yet to be done as we work towards a more perfect union. I continue to have hope even when I feel hopeless because my ancestors would have it no other way. And because scripture tells us that weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. And while I remember a great deal that day, what I remember most is walking back onto the House floor, into the chamber that morning to complete our work. The morning when democracy prevailed. Remember, reflect, recommit.
Delaware Congressmember Lisa Blunt Rochester speaking Thursday. We're joined now by New York University Professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's an expert in the psychology of authoritarianism and the author of Strong Men, How They Rise, Why They Succeed, How They Fall. She also publishes Lucid, a newsletter on threats to democracy. Can you put what happened yesterday in the context of your study of fascism, the anniversary of what happened a year ago, Professor?
Yeah, so Trump was never going to be, he was never a president who resembled either a Republican or Democrat head of state. He ruled as an autocrat. His priorities were autocratic ones, making money off the presidency, spreading hatred, and creating a personality cult. And so when he lost the election, it was easy to predict, as I did in Strong Men, that he wouldn't leave quietly. Because Democratic, with a small d, presidents, they respect the transfer of power and they think about their legacy. But for somebody like Trump, who needs immunity for prosecution and needs the adulation, it's like a kind of existential threat to have to leave. And so he tried everything. He tried martial law. He tried electoral manipulation. And then he went with his bespoke custom army of thugs. And what's really so disturbing that the GOP, which he remade into an authoritarian party, his personality cult 1 year later is stronger than ever. And very quickly, in the last year, the GOP has come into its own as a far-right authoritarian party, which has enshrined violence as part of the practice of power. That is part of its menu of how you do politics now.
During his speech, President Biden addressed what he called the president's three big lies. Number one, election day itself was an insurrection. Number two, the election results cannot be trusted. And number three, big lie, the mob were the true patriots. Put that in the context of the strongmen you have studied.
So a third of my book is on military coups, and which I thought wouldn't be so relevant for the American reader. And of course, I was wrong. And every single coup or authoritarian takeover is always justified as a patriotic act against tyranny, against corruption. And so Trump had set this up very well, because these big lies only had traction with his followers because he told 30,000 lies before that. And many of those lies for years were trying to take away the legitimacy of the electoral system in people's minds. He started this in 2016, but he won, so he didn't have to use this. So we have to think about how what we saw and what has been going on after January 6th for the last year is the product of this very successful propaganda strategy. And these, so turning, what you also do is you turn it, I call authoritarianism as the upside down world. So Biden's victory becomes the insurrection, and then January 6th becomes the righting of the wrong. And Trump knows how to tell a story. He's a reality TV president. And he was very compelling, this idea that he was the hero, the savior of the nation, who had something taken away from him. And that way, January 6th becomes a kind of morally righteous action.
Just days before the January 6th anniversary, Trump endorsed Hungary's Viktor Orban. He released a statement saying he's done a powerful and wonderful job in protecting Hungary, stopping illegal immigration, creating jobs, etc. Talk about the significance of President Trump in the world and what 2024 could mean if he were to run again.
So I've always seen Trump. Of course, we focus on how he came to power to destroy American democracy. That was his goal. But his other agenda was detaching America from the democratic world order and inserting it into what I've been calling since 2017 Axis 2.0. This kind of far right autocratic order. A lot of it's funded by Putin. And Orban has made Budapest a kind of hub of these far-right networks, which remind me of what I, you know, initially studied was these fascist networks of this fascist internationalism in the 1930s. Now, Trump really identifies with Orban because Orban is somebody who was a centrist, and then he was voted out, and he spent some years getting back to power. And then he arranged things. He has this electoral autocracy where you hold elections and then you fix them so that he doesn't have to leave, you know, in his mind. And the GOP has embraced Hungary, and they really see Hungary's present as America's future. And so Tucker Carlson, you know, had a whole week of broadcasting there. And even Mike Pence, who's not the most worldly person, trotted over to Budapest and talked about how he hoped that abortion rights would be taken away soon. So Hungary is this model of white Christian supremacy, anti-trans, homophobic. It checks all the boxes of what the GOP is actually today.
Finally, we talk about him as a model and him modeling himself on autocrats around the world. But what about him as a model at home for people like Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor? You lay out in a very chilling piece this image of DeSantis surrounded by the people he wants to basically deputize as what his opponent in running for governor has talked about as his secret police.
Yeah, Ron DeSantis is an example. So when you have somebody like Trump who imposes this kind of authoritarian party discipline, the system populates with mini Trumps. They used to be called mini Duces and mini Hitlers, and now we have these mini Trumps. And so what we've seen is in places like Texas and Florida, states are becoming laboratories of autocracy. And DeSantis is particularly disturbing because, you know, he wants to have his own civilian National Guard, and many states have those. But I discovered doing research that he's also establishing an office for, quote, election integrity, which is code speak for election fraud, where it's going to have its own prosecutors and investigators. So anybody who, if there's like an election result in the state that DeSantis doesn't like, he can have his goons go after them and accuse them of violating election law. And they've made what used to be misdemeanors into felonies. So these people could be put in jail. So this is an example of the kind of authoritarian system at the state level that DeSantis has planned.
Ruth Ben-Ghiad, I want to thank you for being with us, expert in the psychology of authoritarianism and fascism. She is the author of Strong Men, How They Rise, Why They Succeed, How They Fall, a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, and she publishes Lucid, a newsletter on threats to democracy. Coming up, the CDC is predicting 84,000 people will die in the United States of COVID over the next 4 weeks. We'll speak with emergency room Dr. Craig Spencer. Stay with us. Woods by Yasmin Williams. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look now at the skyrocketing number of COVID infections, the World Health Organization says global coronavirus cases reached a record 9.5 million last week, up 70% from the prior week. On Monday, the U.S. reported a single-day record of 1 million new infections. The CDC predicts in the next month more than 84,000 people in the U.S. could die of COVID-19. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned Thursday the fast-spreading Omicron variant should not be categorized as a mild virus.
Like previous variants, Omicron is hospitalizing people and it's killing people. In fact, the tsunami of cases is so huge and quick that it is overwhelming health systems around the world.
This comes as health experts on Biden's advisory team during his campaign published several critical op-eds Thursday in the Journal of the American Medical Association, urging him to adopt more aggressive use of vaccine mandates and a verification system for vaccination. Today, the Supreme Court's hearing arguments in cases that challenge federal efforts to enforce a vaccine or testing requirement for large employers, as well as a vaccine mandate for most healthcare workers. The cases could determine vaccine requirements for some 80 million people. Meanwhile, the surge in COVID-19 infections is filling up emergency rooms nationwide, with the National Guard being called in to help in a number of states. For more, we're joined by New York emergency room physician Dr. Craig Spencer, whose tweet Monday night went viral. It began, quote, "Just leaving the ER. It was a long day and a stunning amount of COVID. Today, I worked in an area that was temporarily converted into a makeshift ICU during the first COVID wave. Here's what's different from then, and also what challenges we're facing with this surge in NYC. Dr. Spencer, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you lay out what you're seeing?
Absolutely. As I pointed out a couple days ago, you know, in some ways, things are relatively better. You know, we're not seeing the same number of patients that need immediate stabilization with a breathing tube, that need to be put on life support. A lot of that is due to the fact that we're much better at treating this disease now. We have tools, we have high flow oxygen, we have other things that we can go to because we've learned so much over the past few years. But the problem is that the amount of volume that we're seeing threatens to really wash away any added benefit from either a milder variant or even all that experience that we've learned and those tools that we built up over the past few years. So what we're seeing is just a lot of people, especially here in New York City, where it feels like nearly everyone has COVID, coming in, you know, many, primarily the unvaccinated, with classic symptoms, short of breath, needing oxygen, but many other patients for whom COVID is exacerbating kind of underlying or chronic illnesses, putting them in the hospital and making them worse.
So you describe diabetics in whom COVID precipitated diabetic ketoacidosis, a serious and life-threatening condition. Older folks sick with COVID just 2 weeks to get out of bed, can't walk, so can't leave the hospital. Relatively few needed oxygen, but still so many needed hospitalization. And the COVID patients next to the non-COVID patients, people who spent so much time protecting themselves from COVID.
Yeah, this is what a big concern for a lot of us is now, is that, you know, look, coming into the Omicron surge, we already had hospitals that were filled to capacity from Delta and from non-COVID illness, from people who had put off some of their elective care or had put off going to the hospital because of fear of the virus or issues around insurance, many other problems that we've seen in a healthcare system that, quite frankly, even before the pandemic, wasn't up to the task. And then what we're seeing over the past few weeks with more and more patients being brought in is that, you know, we're having to put patients anywhere we can. We don't have the space. We also don't have the providers. We have so many of my colleagues, even though the majority of us are thankfully vaccinated and are not going to get really sick from an infection, a lot of people being around COVID all day are getting exposed or getting mild breakthrough infections, and that's forcing them to be sidelined for, you know, 5, 7, 10 days. putting an even greater staffing crisis on top of a space crisis and the surge of cases that we're seeing.
Can you talk about that, Dr. Spencer? Both the psychology and the health of the healthcare workers and what this means. I mean, we're moving into the third year of this pandemic and how people are keeping up their strength and how many healthcare workers are leaving.
It's a really good question. I remember in March 2020, I said then that this is going to scar a generation of healthcare workers. And that was before this impacted the rest of the country the way that it had here in the Northeast. You know, look, imagine if you're not a healthcare worker listening to this, imagine how sick you are of this pandemic, of the cancellation of birthday parties or family meetups. For us, it's the exact same, except that we have to go to work every single day, seeing our colleagues get sick, seeing patients, you know, that are really unwell, continuing to do this year after year at this point. It's incredibly exhausting. A lot of people have left the profession. A lot of people just can't deal with the physical or, more importantly, the mental toll now of seeing this, you know, day in and day out, and are leaving the profession. And it is causing a crisis. And on top of that crisis, we're seeing staffing levels now, you know, at record lows. And it's challenging our ability to provide the high quality care we want to, not for, you know, just COVID patients, but for non-COVID patients as well that are coming to emergency rooms and hospitals in ever increasing numbers.
And can you talk about the confusing CDC guidance, saying people can go back to work after 5 days without a test if they mask up? And people saying, well, wait a second here. Are you just saying that because there aren't enough tests to go around? And then the whole issue of masking, that cloth masks do not make it right now, that we're talking about having to have KN or N95 or KN or N94 masks, you know, many ply masks, and what that means for people who can't afford or don't have access to this kind of mask that everyone should be wearing.
Well, I think both of those are related, and I'll address those separately. But collectively, I think what's important is that it is shameful that 2 years into this, you know, we don't have a system whereby every person in this country, and even more so around the world, should have access to those high-quality masks that we've needed, not just over the past few weeks, but longer, or that it's so difficult for people to get a test. The fact that it costs $10 to $12 or $15 per test is absolutely incredulous and unacceptable at this point. You know, we should have been doing more before Omicron arrived, and even once we knew that Omicron was coming at the end of November, to get tests out to every single person in this country. Because right now what we're seeing is that people with means and resources are able to go out and find them and buy them online, are able to stockpile, and they're using that to keep their family safe. But as we've seen throughout this pandemic, this is disproportionately impacting the people that do not have the means and the resources to, you know, to spend the time in line getting a test, or to, you know, spend a bunch of time online at night finding out where they can get, you know, tests from, or, you know, different types of masks and research what may be best for them. The fact is that we should have collectively done more, as opposed to focusing, like the CDC guidance does, on individual decisions and the impact of those individual decisions. I think that the CDC guidance around testing is actually probably, for the majority of people, quite true. After 5 days, the likelihood that you're going to infect other people is probably pretty low. But collectively, as we have Omicron spreading everywhere, this being the most transmissible virus perhaps that we've ever seen as humankind, we need guidance that helps us collectively make the right decisions, because every one of these infections has a collective impact.
Dr. Craig Spencer, you're not only a New York City emergency room doctor, but you are director of global health in emergency medicine at Columbia University. You yourself had Ebola, working with people in Africa years ago, and had to be jetted back to the United States to be treated. You certainly know about deadly epidemics, and I wanted to ask about this issue of vaccine equity. Next week, we're going to be speaking with a man who is part of the Moderna trial. And now he is not going to continue to be a part of a trial for boosters, as each vaccine has to be changed, because he says Moderna and Pfizer and these corporations are making billions, yet not making these vaccines available to the world. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Absolutely. Global vaccine inequity has been, I think, one of the most profound and disappointing aspects of this pandemic over the past year. You know, it's great that everyone here has the ability to walk into a pharmacy now and get a vaccine or get a booster that can keep us and our family safe. But people around the world should have the same access. And there has been a very intentional campaign by pharmaceutical companies to do whatever they can to reap the most profit of this at the expense of people all around the world that continue to lack access to healthcare workers. You know, over 115,000 of my colleagues that have died around the world, and still many of them, the majority of them in places like sub-Saharan Africa, still haven't been able to receive access to a vaccine. I was texting with a good friend of mine the other day who lives and works in East Africa, in Burundi. And he said, you know, he's going to try to take the trip to the capital to see if there's a vaccine available, but he's not sure that there is. Now, this is completely unacceptable. It is responsible, as we've seen, to leading to the conditions where more potentially immune evasive variants can arrive and potentially undermine the efficacy of our vaccines here. We should have, not as a country, but as a globe, done incredibly more since day one to scale up the production of these highly effective vaccines, not just here in the U.S., where they've long been made and where they can make a big profit, but everywhere all around the world, including in sub-Saharan Africa, where over 99% of all vaccines before the pandemic had to be brought in from other countries because the capacity had never been built up and hadn't been supported. And we're going to end this pandemic in a not much better position than when we started it.
And the whole issue of these variants that are rapidly changing, that if we don't vaccinate the world, this will continue. The new discussion of a variant that's come out of Cameroon and now in France, of course, Omicron. You had South Africa, and then you had Delta, India, although we don't really know where they start. They could, you know, Omicron might have gone to South Africa from Europe. But the what it means if you don't take a global approach, no one is safe.
Absolutely. We have been, I've been saying this for years, you know, after our response to Ebola and many other infectious pathogens. Look, the United States has more resources than really anyone else in the world, but there is absolutely no wall that we can build high enough to keep infectious disease threats that may originate in other places away from attacking and impacting our population here. Unless we think about how to manage not just COVID, but all other infectious threats globally, not just with a domestic focus, we will find ourselves hit time and time again. And there is no vaccine strong enough, and as I said, no wall big enough or moat large enough that it's going to be able to keep these infectious diseases from coming to our shores. We need to be more proactive in doing more for the world and less focus on what we can just for our own population at home. That is a losing strategy time and time again.
The idea that the U.S. is the most powerful, richest country in the world has the worst record when it comes to COVID. I mean, you have the global picture where there has to be a global health system, and you have the picture at home. What does this say to you about having public health care in the United States, the idea of Medicare for all? How do you see it as intimately linked to dealing with pandemics like these, what we've lost by not having it?
I think for so many people that maybe didn't buy into this idea a couple years ago, if it has not become obvious over the past 2 years, I don't know what will make it so. Look, we had issues around vaccine hesitancy, and we know that one of the best ways to get people vaccinated who may have questions at first is to not shame them into doing so. It's to have a conversation with them, and the people that need to be having those conversations are healthcare providers that people trust. But we have underfunded primary health care in this country for so long. A lot of people don't have access to a primary health care provider, or if they do, it's many months out. Sure, you can go see a specialist. Sure, you can see. Hey, but we haven't focused on the right things, which is preventative care, stopping people from getting out of the hospital, stopping people from getting sicker. All of these things that we need to do are things we've needed to do from before the pandemic started and have been exacerbated by it, by making sure everyone has access to a primary care provider that is affordable, accessible in real time, don't have to wait months for, and having a public health system that isn't subservient to the pharmaceutical system here in the U.S. Public health, where we're able to focus on preventative health, on social determinants of health, on recognizing that it's not just about whether you have good insurance or no insurance at all, but that people are coming to the healthcare system with everything else that they bring, you know, their access to employment, their understanding of their illness, their access and their previous history of education. And we just unfortunately have not been able to meld those things over the past few years, the past few decades in this country, because we have a model where in the U.S., medicine is unfortunately a business, and it's an incredibly strong and powerful one.
Finally, children, Dr. Spencer. You're a New York City emergency room doctor. What about children and Omicron? The whole debate around the country, around schools being such a major vector of COVID.
Yeah, it's really hard to say. You know, up until now, we've known that schools can and should be safe, and that we should be doing everything that we can to keep schools open. We know the mental health impact of having them open is profound. And by all means, schools should be open and bars should be closed if we need to take any type of intervention, right? And it's the exact opposite here in many places in New York City and all around the country, where you have, you know, bars open and schools closed. Now, we need to do everything we can to make sure that our students are safe. And we can do that with ventilation, with masking. We need to make sure that all of our providers, our teachers, everyone else that is working in those places is safe as well. And we have access to vaccines, but still other people have underlying medical issues. You know, we know that thankfully, for the most part, Omicron and at least other COVID variants, COVID strains, haven't tended to impact children in the same severe way as it has older adults, for example. But that doesn't mean that it hasn't been impactful and that kids don't or potentially can't get infected at school and bring that home to loved ones, to parents, to grandparents who may be living with them. So I think the point of this needs to be that the safest way that we can keep kids in school is to take those measures, to get them vaccinated if they're eligible. And if not, make sure all the people that are around them are vaccinated as well.
Dr. Craig Spencer, we want to thank you for being with us, New York City Emergency Room Doctor and Director of Global Health and Emergency Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. He's been treating coronavirus patients since the pandemic began. Coming up, three protesters are killed in Sudan, bringing the total to around 60 killed since October's military coup. We'll go to Khartoum for the latest. Bimaza by Abdelkarim El-Kabli, the Sudanese singer, composer, and humanitarian, died last month at the age of 89. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Sudan, where at least three people were killed Thursday during protests against military rule, the demonstration came 4 days after Abdallah Hamdok resigned as Sudan's prime minister. He was deposed in a military coup on October 25th and then restored to power in November by the military because of public outcry. But protesters have been demanding civilian rule in Sudan for years. In 2019, mass mobilizations led to the toppling of Sudan's longtime strongman, Omar al-Bashir. A joint military-civilian governing council was then formed, but the military coup in October ended what was supposed to be a transition to civilian rule. According to the Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors, at least 60 people have been killed by security forces since the coup in October. We go now to Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, where we're joined by the Sudanese activist Marine Al-Neil. Marine, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what's happening in the streets, the mass protests, and this latest killing by security forces?
Thank you, Emma Goodman, for shedding light on this. Currently, Sudan is that we have ongoing protests calling for a civilian government, calling for the military to go back to its barricades and to no longer be part of the political scene. We have now neighborhood resistance committees announcing the protest schedule by the month. So we've had that in December, and now we have that for January. And these protests have been faced by violent repression by military forces, police forces, rapid support forces, and other militias and armed forces of the government. Protesters are facing tear gas, beatings, rubber bullets, and live ammunition, and even anti-craft machinery. We've had a martyr that has died by this type of weapons. And on the days of the scheduled and announced protests, what we see is that from the night before, the bridges of the tri-capital city of Khartoum are barricaded with shipping containers to not allow the protesters to join each other in the tri-capital city. However, previously, the protesters managed to overcome these containers peacefully. And after the protests, usually we see the armed forces raiding hospitals, attacking doctors and other medical staff, even arresting some of the injured and sometimes chasing the vehicles that have tried to transport the injured from the protests to hospitals. One of the martyrs of yesterday's protest was chased by armed forces when the other protesters tried to rescue him and transport him to a nearby hospital.
Can you lay out what has taken place with Hamdok resigning, the prime minister, and just lay out for us, give us a history of the who's running, who are the people leading the uprising, first knocking out al-Bashir, and then the civilian-military partnership that ended in a military coup in October, and the more demands for there to be civilian rule.
So in 2019, the Sudanese Professionals Association was leading the protest. The protests were the main chants were being Hurriya, Salam, Adala, freedom, peace, and justice. And that ended with the ousting of Omar al-Bashir. And then a power-sharing deal was signed between the Forces of Freedom and Change, which the Sudanese Professional Association was part of. And that power sharing deal led to the transitional government that has lasted for about 2 years and ended with the military coup on October 25th of 2020. Now, what the people are calling for is the main slogans are no negotiation, no partnership, no legitimacy. So people are no longer interested in any sort of partnership with the military. In 2019, many people were displeased with the partnership, and now mostly people are outright rejecting any form of partnership with the military. And currently, although we're seeing on a lot of international media outlets that these protests are being called for by the Forces of Freedom and Change or the Sudanese Professionals Association, that is far from the reality. In reality, the entities that are leading this movement are the neighborhood resistance committees, which have developed mainly in 2019 to help organize the protests in neighborhoods, in different neighborhoods, and are now the leading entity announcing the protests and are actually the voice of the people that is still saying no negotiation, no partnership, no legitimacy. And now, as for Hamdok's resignation, it has been mostly insignificant for the protests on the ground, as since he signed on November 21st, a deal with General Lieutenant Burhan, the head of the military coup council. People have considered him the secretary of the coup. He was no longer relevant to the people. And bear in mind, he signed that agreement as an individual. It's more like a work contract with the coup rather than any agreement. So his resignation has been irrelevant to people. Some have chanted, whether he resigned or not, the schedule keeps going. It's basically the schedule of the announced protests.
And so what are the demands right now? How are other African countries responding? And what are you calling on? What are activists calling on the West to do, and particularly the United States' role?
Currently, the main demand is for the military to get out of the political scene. We are demanding a genuine civilian government, not a power-sharing deal of unequivalent parties, rather a genuinely civilian leadership. That is the main demand. And what we're seeing from international entities is that there's some condemnation of the violent repression of the protests. However, with that comes an urging of the current authority to go back to the 2019 deal, or to go back to a pre-coup state. And that's not what the people are asking for. And that is not what will lead to stability. So let's say, even for example, if General Lieutenant Burhan manages to find a civilian to take over the role of the prime minister, that is still not what people are calling for. And definitely that will not lead to stability. More protests will continue on happening until we reach our demands to be genuinely met and the military to be out of power.
And the role of the World Bank and the IMF?
Yes, so in essence, these protests and the demands of the people, whether before the coup or right now, it is about livelihood. And we've seen that the transitional government was not prioritizing the livelihood of the Sudanese people. And the military is definitely not prioritizing the livelihood of the Sudanese people. It is killing us. We now have 60 martyrs, at least, since the coup. We now want a civilian leadership that will prioritize our livelihood and not the international interests of the IMF or the World Bank. And also, we don't want the military that will also prioritize their own financial interests and their own clinging to power.
Finally, the role of COVID. I mean, the bravery of everyone going out, facing the military, and also dealing with this pandemic. We have 20 seconds.
Yes, the protesters are trying to stick to some measures of wearing masks. What has been helping is that we're already wearing the masks for tear gas. So you see most protesters are trying to take some measurements. However, considering the situation and the health, the state of the healthcare system here in Sudan, we are facing a lot of risk that is a combination of both the military attacking us and the risk that we put ourselves in and our loved ones with the COVID and the pandemic.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Maureen. Please stay safe. Maureen Al-Neil, Sudanese activist, joining us from Khartoum, Sudan. That does it for our show. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. I'm Amy Goodman.